Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Our guest today is the Director of Research and Biomedical Informatics here at the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, and in fact, he was the founding member of the research team here at the Academy. He's had quite an impressive career as a researcher, working for both the Harvard School of Public Health and Johns Hopkins before coming to work for us. Today, we're going to talk to him about how he got involved in research, how he ended up at the IAED, and a study he's been working on involving heart attacks that were coded as low acuity calls at dispatch. Welcome, Chris Olola.
Thank you, Isabel, for having me.
So let's start by letting our listeners get to know you a bit. You were born and you grew up in Kenya, which is where you started in research. Can you tell us about the work that you did there and how you got from there to Salt Lake City?
Thank you. So my public health profession started way back about 26 years ago in Kenya. I worked with the Ministry of Health Kenya from 1992 to about 95, doing primarily research in malaria.
Mm-hmm.
Late, or rather early 2000, I went into private sector, working with a project that was looking at severe malaria in African children. This was funded by NIH, but collaborated by Michigan State University and Harvard School of Public Health. This was doing observational studies and randomized control trials in children who are comatose. So we did quite a number of studies looking at dose escalations and things like that, and we published widely in that particular area. During that time, I was the clinical data coordinator for the severe malaria in African children, which I've just talked about. And after about 5 years working to that project, I decided to go for my further studies. And one of the programs that I was interested in was biomedical informatics. And this was offered at the School of Medicine at the University of Utah.
And just before we move on, can you just tell us in kind of layman's terms, what is biomedical informatics?
Good question. So biomedical informatics is basically in the application of technology and information science in healthcare. So how you manage information in terms of quality, accuracy, and how effective it is in terms of management of electronic medical records in healthcare. So that's what it is.
All right. And what made you interested in biomedical informatics? I mean, what's the appeal?
So, yeah, it's a long story. But when I started working with the Ministry of Health, I was employed as a systems analyst, stroke statistician. And then, so this combined both statistics and technology. But basically, my training was in statistics and a minor in computer science. Now, when I went for my master's in University of Leeds in the UK, I decided to do management information systems, which was not actually involving statistics. So going back home, I started working in IT, how IT is applied in healthcare. But I wanted something that could marry both statistics and computer science together. And so I came across this program called informatics, which is basically combining statistics and computer science and applying that in management of information in healthcare.
So that's interesting that it combines public health and the statistics and the computer science and IT and almost a management component too, to take all of that information and figure out what to do with it.
Absolutely.
So then after you finished your program at the University of Utah, how did you end up at the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch?
Yeah. So when I was doing my program at the University of Utah, I was also looking for a part-time job. And so one day I was looking at the university magazine called Chronicle, and I came across an advertisement about this position. By that time, it was research data analyst mm-hmm. for the academy. I had no idea what the academy is. I had no idea what dispatch was.
Right.
But I went through the website for the academy and searched about things on dispatch and learned a lot about it. So I got really interested in the mission of the academy. And so I applied for the job. I came for the interview, talked to Dr. Clausen and a few other people in the organization, and the interview was really interesting. So I said, okay, if I'm taken for this position, I think it's something that I would like to venture into, because despite my many years in public health, dispatch was really new to me and very mm-hmm. fascinating. So I wanted to find out more about it.
And so now, since that time, you've been here about 10 years, so you must have found dispatch interesting. So for somebody with such a broad public health background, you seem to have really dug into the emergency dispatch research. So what is it about emergency dispatch that's so interesting?
Good question. So one thing that I really liked was the mission of the academy. As you know, informaticians are very much interested in how information is managed mm-hmm. in terms of accuracy, completeness, and things like that. And when I looked at the academy mission, one of the things that caught my attention was supplying the right information at the right time to the right person in a more complete sense, so that people could make proper decisions to service the calls that they receive. So I was very much interested in knowing how the information is managed and what type of impact it actually has on the people who call 911. And one thing that I've loved is that I'm able to see the impact of what I contribute to the academy directly on the people who call 911. And in terms of standards, this is one thing that is very key in informatics, how you set standards in healthcare. And I came to realize after a few years that standard is a very key component of what we do at the academy.
Mm.
And so being a standard-setting organization, I'm able to see my contribution in terms of data modeling and coming up with standards that actually have meaningful use in dispatch.
That's fascinating. I hadn't actually thought about dispatch as information in that same way. The idea that what you're trying to do is manage information and make good decisions based on that information. And the idea that the whole purpose of being a dispatcher is to get not just information, but good information and standardized information. And so the protocols then become an information gathering tool, not just a set of questions or a way to deal with a caller. And so then you actually come back in on the other end and deal with the information that's been gathered, not for that individual call or for how to send out a responder, which is what the dispatchers are doing, but how to look at all of that information that's been gathered and then bring it back and learn more about the protocols. So what's the process for that? How does that information that's gathered by a single dispatcher help drive the protocol forward in a general sense?
That's a good summary of what we do. So when information is collected, what we have to do, first of all, this information is collected from different sources.
Mm.
For example, we have dispatch data, we have EPCR, which is the paramedic collected information in the field, and we also have hospital outcomes. So one thing that we do is, once it's collected, we have to integrate these sources so that we can be able to see a comprehensive picture of the entire call. And using that kind of record, we are able to build predictive models that can help us actually optimize the way we predict what is happening on scene. And given that in dispatch we are dealing with a non-visual environment, we don't know what is happening on scene. So the only thing we can do is to try to predict based on what the caller really tells us. So the dispatcher is a key component in terms of collecting the initial information that we then use to build these models that will help us predict what is happening on scene more accurately.
And that overall drives better patient care.
Absolutely. So as we know, patient care starts from 911. Once they call 911, that's where their care starts. And so we look at the entire record all the way to the hospital. And if the systems are not optimized in terms of predicting what is happening, then our care might not be the way we destined it to be.
And that's something we talk about in terms of data integrity, as far as the fact that, for example, we mostly use ACE centers
yes.
in our studies. And I think it would be interesting for dispatchers to realize that what you're saying is that every time they take a call, they're actually helping to improve the system. Because if they take the call and we gather that information and then we use that information to make changes in the protocol, then the dispatchers themselves are the first, not just the first encounter for the call, but they're the first location where information is gathered that then builds the protocol and develops the standard of care.
Exactly. And it's not just the quality of what they put in here, but the quantity as well. Because we rely on quantity and quality in order for us to make good predictive models. And all this starts with the dispatcher. That's where everything starts. So what they put in has got a significant impact on what we actually produce in the end. So they feed the models that we build. So if they put in garbage, what will come out is actually right. garbage. And that's not what we want. We want something that is actually going to be highly sensitive in terms of predicting what is unseen.
So that high-quality information that they put in drives everything from
exactly.
that moment, not just the response, but the improvement in the protocol, the science, everything.
Exactly. And even what type of response the agency sent to the scene as well, because that is informed by what we get from dispatch.
So then as an example of that, let's talk about the study that we mentioned at the beginning. So one of the things that we've been interested in is how accurate are emergency dispatchers using the system at identifying especially very high acuity or very high emergency situations? So one of the things that we looked at was heart attacks or AMIs, and we found that the vast majority of AMIs were being correctly coded as Delta level or sometimes Charlie level calls. But we found some, just a very small percentage, in the alpha level. And so you did a study where you looked at those specific calls that ended up in the low acuity to find out why. So can you tell us a little bit about that study?
Yeah, thank you. So one of the things is that in Utah, we are very fortunate to have a Utah Department of Health that collects all data from hospitals. In dispatch, what we struggle with mostly is getting outcome data from the hospital. And this is very critical in order for us to build models that are more predictive of what is happening. So in Utah, what we did is we collected data from the Utah Department of Health that consists of hospital outcome data and also EMS data. And we took this and did what we call probabilistic linkage using baseline demographic information of callers and link it to dispatch data.
So that allowed you to take the outcome data and link that up so that you could find exactly which outcomes came from which dispatch call.
Exactly.
Okay.
So using the what we call the International Classification of Diseases ICD-9 codes that are issued by the hospitals at dispatch, we're able to know exactly the true AMIs that were seen at the hospital. But as you said, our interest was to see how many of these cases are actually being seen at the alpha level. So we took all the alpha level cases from dispatch and looked down to the hospital and seen where these AMIs, how many AMIs were actually categorized as alphas. And as you said correctly, the percentage was quite low. Under 1% of all those cases were AMIs at the alpha level. And so we wanted to dig deep and find out, because for a number of years, we've always known that there's some of these severe cases in those lower levels. But in dispatch, we would rather be more sensitive than specific. So we knew these cases are there. But what we wanted to know now is, how do we filter these cases out of the alpha level and have them coded in higher level priorities like deltas or Charlies?
So is there anything, you were looking at whether there was anything that characterizes those specific calls.
Exactly.
So that we could identify them and pick them out.
Exactly, and pick them out and group them in the right categories in terms of priorities. So we looked at those alpha AMIs and looked at the signs and symptoms that were recorded by the dispatcher and also recorded by the paramedics on scene. And funnily enough, what we found was not very surprising, because the kind of symptoms we saw were very atypical, things that are very characteristics of silent AMIs, for example. It was very hard to differentiate them from other AMIs that were actually recorded in the higher priorities.
So what is a silent AMI?
So silent AMIs is that, so for example, somebody could be having an AMI, but they don't show the symptoms, the sense of symptoms that the callers could actually describe to the dispatcher.
Right.
If they could see the symptoms and accurately describe it to the dispatcher, then they would be moved to other categories. But in this case, the symptoms are not showing up, but the patient actually has an AMI. So they are hidden, kind of, right. What we call silent. So most of the cases we saw, in fact, in our data set, suggested that some of these cases of AMIs might have happened during the hospital because of the dispatch. I mean, the discharge ICD-9 codes were actually assigned at dispatch. I mean, at discharge level.
That's interesting.
They might have not shown up during the call when the caller was calling 911, but eventually showed up in the hospital.
So it's possible that they weren't exactly having an AMI when they called 911.
Exactly.
They were uncomfortable or not feeling well.
Or just sick.
Or just feeling sick. And then what happened was they had an AMI later.
Exactly.
And in fact, if I remember correctly, some of them were in the hospital for days.
So
they could have had an AMI at any point that they were in the hospital.
Exactly. Some of them were in the hospital for even over 14 days, 7 days, 9 days. I think the minimum was like 1 day or 2 days. So the fact that they were assigned an ICD code for AMI and it was not identifiable at the dispatch, it definitely showed that something happened during their stay in hospital. So that might be something that is attributable to silent AMIs. And also, what we also saw in our study was that most of this, in fact, all the cases that we saw of alpha AMIs were confined in just a very small percentage of the chief complaints. As you know, we have over 32 major chief complaints in medical. And in our study, there were about 22 chief complaints. But overall, the alpha AMIs were only confined in about 5 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the top one, of course, as expected, was sick person protocol.
And falls, I think, was another
and
high
falls
level
was
one.
Another one, yeah. Unconscious, and also abdominal pain. But the vast majority, almost 50% of them, were in sick person.
Hmm. So they were presenting with some kind of symptom, maybe of just feeling unwell.
Exactly.
But not any symptom that was identifiable at the time as a heart attack
or
a coming heart attack.
Not showing any primary, what we could call a primary symptom or something like that, like chest pain, for example. If we had chest pain, they would be classified in appropriate protocols or priority levels.
Mm-hmm.
So that prompted us to think of other studies. But the other thing we observed was that age might also be a factor.
Mm.
Most of the AMIs that we saw were actually very older patients, like over 75 years of age. Males were starting from something like 35 years and above. Females were much older. So we are suspecting that there could be something in terms of age or even some kind of symptoms that we still don't know about that could filter these people out of the alpha level coding.
And in fact, when we looked at the other literature on heart attacks, we did find that older people tended to present with different symptoms. So they didn't have the stereotypical left chest pain or left arm pain or those
exactly.
kinds of typical symptoms. They had other symptoms. So it wasn't surprising that we found the same thing at dispatch that they find at hospitals. And in fact, that our level of missing heart attacks was only about the same as the ER, the emergency department, or the hospital's missing heart attacks, because they don't get all of them either.
That's correct. So as you said, in other studies, we've seen almost similar things. So it's not that we are missing these cases in dispatch, but there are some symptoms that are not very specific that we could say, okay, the dispatcher could be able to pick up these cases. So it's not a missed opportunity, but it's just because of the way the case is presented to the dispatcher. The same thing, as you said, in the hospital, they miss quite a bit just because of the symptoms that come and go. So they're not able to actually get that case at that particular time. So in our studies, we've seen a lot, especially in this one, we also saw that one other thing is that although these cases were categorized in alpha level, they also received good care.
Mm.
Most of them, in fact, over 50% of them were discharged to a medical facility, maybe for further follow-up. That showed us that although they were actually in alpha levels, eventually they ended up being in a good place where they could get in adequate care.
So even though they had a heart attack they did get an ambulance and they were taken to the hospital and they were cared for well. And all or most of them survived.
All of them survived, which was a good thing. So that was something that we didn't know about, that most of them actually get good care. But because of this study, we were able to identify that. And I think that was telling us that actually the protocol works the way it's supposed to be.
Well, and the idea that less than 1% of the alphas are these heart attacks, I mean, that's a very, very small level of misses.
Exactly. Very small.
So for the last 10 years or so, you've been studying primarily the protocol and the kind of study that you're talking about now, looking at outcomes or looking at the accuracy or predictive value of the protocol. And one of the things that the research team under your direction has been doing is moving a little bit outside of just looking at the protocols, looking more at dispatch in general.
Correct.
So where do you see the future of the research department? What kinds of studies do you see the research team doing in the future?
Good question. So when we started research in the academy, the main thing was to actually try to generate evidence. What was being studied before I joined the academy was kind of based on people's experience in dispatch. Now, what we wanted to do is to validate our protocols and show people that actually what we are saying these protocols do, actually they do. So we've really done a lot of that over the years, and we think that we've done a good job in demonstrating that this protocol works, and where they don't work, we have tried to correct the situation and make them more predictive. Now, in my view, what I see is for us now, because what we've been doing in the past is looking at retrospective data, data that has been collected in the past without any idea on what type of studies are going to be done. So what we do is what we call secondary use of the data, trying to take that data and querying it and trying to see whether they can drive any hypotheses that we can study. Now, what I think we need to do now is to do what we call more prospective studies, collecting data in mind, having an idea in mind on what you want to achieve. So we are looking at data prospectively. And this could involve things like randomized control trials that are going to be very effective in us creating better models that would predict what is happening on scene. So prospective studies is what I think we need to go to. And also, one of the things that we'd like to do is to do what we call outreach programs, going to the communities and involving the communities in what we do. This has got various advantages, for example, making us more visible to the communities, letting them know what we do and what the impact of what we do has on their lives. So I think these are some areas that I would like us to venture into.
And one last thing before we go, which is, what can you tell people who are just getting interested in research or maybe don't know whether it's something they want to get involved in? What do you love about it? Why would anybody get involved with it?
What I love is in research is that everybody's doing research. It's only that they don't know that they're doing it. Everybody has a question in mind and they want a solution to it. And that is research. So nobody should share about doing research. You're already doing it. You only don't know that you're doing it. You need just to formalize it and come up with a study. And the academy is there to support anybody who is interested in research in dispatch. We have enough expertise. We are ready to help anyone who is interested and have them publish. We cannot just do research in our heads and not disseminate that information to the public. So the academy is there to help them not only do the study, but also publish and disseminate their findings.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch In Depth. Remember, it really helps us if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch In Depth is hosted by me, Isabel Gardette. Our producer is Becca Barris. Reading Roberts is the technical director, and Scott Robinson is our executive producer.